Okay, let's get started. Good morning, everybody. Unless you were here at 7:30, if you had 7:30 lab, then it's like almost good afternoon to you guys. Okay, but today is the 16th of February, and we're going to start axial skeleton. All right, so if we take all the bones in your body, we make something out of it. What do we make out of it? The skeleton, right? Or in terms of systematic thinking, you could say the skeletal system, right? Skeletal system. And we learned what the skeletal system is made out of in the last chapter. Bones, but not just bones, but also cartilage and ligaments, because a ligament is dense connective tissue that is a bone-to-bone connection. It's very similar to a muscle-to-bone connection, but it's a bone-to-bone connection. Let me get these lights more the way I like them. That's pretty good. That's even better. All right, so if we take all the bones of the body, we can group them into two categories. What are the two categories we could take any bone and group it into? It's either going to go into one or the other. So it's going to be axial skeleton or appendicular skeleton. Axial skeleton is what we're concerned with in this chapter, and it is bones of the skull, the vertebral column, and the rib cage, as well as a funny little bone that is deep to the mandible and has a horseshoe shape just like a mandible. That's called a hyoid bone. That's also part of the axial skeleton. All right, but since this is the first chapter where we start talking about bones, we've got to learn some nomenclature about bones, but I think you guys are doing pretty good with nomenclature because of lab. All right, some of the major kinds of nomenclatures you should be aware of. All right, there are things called processes. All right, so a process you should know the function of and a general definition. A general definition of a process is that it's a rough raised area on a bone and it's used for, most of the time, what kind of function? Muscle attachment. But it could be a ligament. There could be a ligament attached to it, but most likely it's going to be a tendon that's attached to it. Okay, that's a process. There are various names of processes, like a tubercle, tuberosity, trochanter, epicondyle, malleolus. If it's a long, broad raised area on a bone, we call it a crest. If it's a really long but narrow that's sticking away like a pin or a pencil or something, we might call that a spine. And if it's a long raised process but it's not very tall, then we would just call that a line. But in each case, these are the kinds of things that are going to have muscles attached to them. And don't forget, when something is pulling on a bone, that bone is going to respond by getting bigger and stronger in that area where it gets pulled on. And that's why processes are bigger and stronger than most other parts of the bone. All right, another kind of landmark that you should be aware of is a depression or a bowl. And the function of that is for holding something, right? And typically we call those fossa. And it could, it doesn't look like a bowl, if it's really long and narrow, we might call it a sulcus, the same thing. Another name for a sulcus is a groove. If it is kind of narrow, then we might call it an alveolus. So an alveolus is a small pocket in a bone, like your teeth attached to your mandible and maxilla with a little pocket. And that's what we call an alveolus. So you don't have a whole lot of alveoli in your body, but that's a special kind of fossa, and they're all for holding something. All right, what's the name of a hole in a bone? That anatomical name. Foramen, plural would be foramina. All right, and that's always used as a passageway. That's the function. Now, meatus is a special kind of foramina. It doesn't go all the way through the temporal bone. You have an external meatus, external acoustic meatus. That's how sound energy enters the temporal bone and stimulates some organs for hearing. Okay, a canal is a hole in a bone that goes all the way through, but it's not like a little hole that you have in a piece of paper when you use a paper puncher to make a hole in it. A canal is long, so it's more like a tunnel. So it's going through a thick part of the bone, or maybe it actually goes inside the bone and curves around so that you can't even see the external and internal part of the canal, right? Unless you have a piece of thread and you can thread it through. A fissure is a hole, but it's not going to be round. It's not going to be oval. It's going to be elongated. So it's going to be very long. So we call that a fissure. And then we have some holes that don't go all the way through, kind of like a meatus, and we call those sinuses. And I can think of like a sinus in a long bone. We actually call that a cavity. Okay, sinus and a cavity are the same thing. Like the medullary cavity, you could call that the medullary sinus in a long bone. But we also have some paranasal sinuses and a few bones in our skull that are filled with important lymphatic tissue to help fight infection, so that when we breathe in bacteria, viruses, every time we take a breath, there's dust particles filled with stuff that helps fight infections that normally would occur to us. And you know, they become infected, and then you'd call that a sinusitis, right? Okay. All right, and then there are smooth articulating surfaces on bones. And typically we call those condyles. So it's a raised area, kind of like a process, but the distinction here is since it's going to form a joint, the function is forming articulations, it's going to be smooth so that when bones move over each other, they slide, they don't rub and grind each other down. All right, so it's a lot different kind of feel with your fingertip compared to a process. And these go by the name of condyle or head. Facet sometimes is like a fossa. It's a depression, but it's a smooth depression. And then we have a couple that have a very special name, and we find these on the humerus. There's the trochlea and the capitulum. These are condylar surfaces that are smooth for articulating. They help make the elbow joint. And we find the trochlea is going to be medial and the capitulum is going to be lateral. And when we get into the next chapter, you'll see how they relate to each other, but not in the axial skeleton because these are in the arm. Okay. Then there's something called a ramus. Whenever you have a bone, major part of a bone, we call that the body. And if there's a projection that makes a 90-degree bend and it's almost as big as the major body, the major part of the bone, we call that a ramus. So your mandible, the body is like horizontal to the floor, and then it makes a 90-degree turn and goes to the top of your head. That part that moves superiorly up to reach into the temporal bone, we call that the mandibular ramus. Other bones might have a ramus, like the pubic bone and ischium bone that we're going to look at next week. Okay, so here's the skeleton. I'm not sure this is an exam figure, but you should know the names of all of these bones for sure eventually, so it probably would be a good exam figure, I would guess. You don't have to know how many bones are in the skull, how many make up the vertebral column or thoracic cage, but I just kind of put them there just for fun, okay? So these are the names of bones, and guess what? In this class, we're going to know pretty much all the names of bones except for some that are in the ankle and the wrist. All right, so don't forget, we can break the skeleton down into axial skeleton and appendicular skeleton, and today we're just going to be concerned with axial skeleton. So cranial, so bones that make up the head. Let's look at some of these. So we got a posterior view, and then here's the skull. And just like all the bones in the skeleton can be broken down into two categories, either axial or appendicular, bones that make the skull can be broken down into two categories as well. There are some that surround the brain and form armor plating around the brain, protected from trauma, and those we call cranial bones. They form the cranial vault. So inside the cranial vault, we find the brain. Right? We find the cranium, but we also find other parts of the brain as well. So it's made up of numerous bones, and you can see these bones come together to form joints. These are mostly immovable joints. They move just ever so slightly, but you can consider them immovable, and we call these sutures. Sutures are joints between bones of the skull that are basically immovable. All right, so the bones that make up the cranium, we have here in the front, anterior, that's the frontal bone, and then two parietal bones. There's a suture that's separating the two parietal bones, and maybe from lab you can remember the name of that suture. Anybody remember the name of that suture? That's a sagittal suture because it's right on the mid-sagittal plane, so that makes perfect sense. Then occipital bone, that's posterior here, and temporal bone, that's just behind your ear, that's the temporal bone. So not typically where you think your temporal region is. Where you think your temporal region is the sphenoid bone right here. Okay, so these are all bones that are immovable. And as opposed to cranial bones, then we have facial bones. And facial bones are important for articulation, for breathing, and for eating, and for facial expression. Right? So it's a form of communication. That includes the mandible, which is the lower jawbone, the maxilla, your upper jawbone, zygomatic. That's a really tiny bone in your face, but it's very prominent feature when you look at somebody. That's the zygomatic or cheekbone. Right? And then we have a nasal bone on the bridge of the nose and a couple bones behind the nasal bone, and it's behind the maxilla, and that would be the lacrimal bone, and then even behind that is going to be the ethmoid bone. So we're going to look forward to learning where some of those bones are. So this slide just shows that you can group skull bones into these two categories, and when you look at this slide, you can see that there is only one joint in the skull. Of all these different bones, there's only one bone that moves with respect to all the rest. And that is the mandible right here. It's a very complicated joint. It can depress and it can elevate. Those are proper terms. But it can also do other things that we're going to talk about when we get into joints. And it articulates with the temporal bone right in this region right here, right within the temporal fossa. Here is the mandibular. What do we call a smooth surface on a bone used for articulation? A condyle. So here is the mandibular condyle that helps form the temporomandibular joint. That's kind of a complicated term, so people usually don't say temporomandibular, they just say TMJ for that joint. All right, and then we on the sides of the skull, they're pretty flat, so that's what we call the squamous part of the skull, and that's mostly made up of the temporal bone, so this is the squamous region of the temporal bone, and here's the squamous region of the parietal bone. All right, so that's kind of a nice introduction. If we take the calvarium off the top of the head, right, we call that the skull cap sometimes, and that's just made out of part of the frontal bone, part of the parietal bones, and part of the occipital bone. It's just a little construct that we use to look inside the cranial vault. We can see three depressions right here. What's a depression used for again? For holding something, and we call these fossa. Here is the anterior cranial fossa. Here is the middle cranial fossa, and then here is the posterior cranial fossa. So this is the frontal bone, so learning bones is extremely helpful because it helps you learn a lot of other kinds of vascular and neuroanatomy. So what lobes of the brain are found within the anterior cranial fossa? This is the frontal bone right here, like the frontal lobes, right? And the middle cranial fossa is made up mostly by the temporal bones here and here, so the temporal lobes are held within the medial cranial fossa and some other parts of the brain. And then here we have the occipital bone in the posterior cranial fossa making most of it up. So the occipital lobe is going to be held in this region right here. So that kind of just underscores what fossa are used for. Okay. So here we just see the fossa. All right. So here's a really good exam figure. You've been quizzed on this quite a bunch. Right, so here you got the condyle, smooth articulating surface, right, of the mandible, mandibular notch. Sometimes if we have a little notch in a bone, we call it a notch, right? And this just gives a little leverage to the mandibular ramus as a result of this coronoid process right here. What's the function of a process? Muscle attachment. There are muscles that attach to the coronoid process for mastication, for eating. All right, so that little process right there is just for mastication. All right, so you also got to know these sutures, like the coronal suture, but that you should know already because that's the coronal plane. That would just line up right on the coronal plane. Here's the squamosal suture or squamous suture. Different books call it by different names because that's right in the squamous region of the skull. All right, and then the lambdoid suture. Occipital mastoid between the, it's on the temporal bone near the mastoid process and occipital bone. So those are most of the sutures that you have to know, but all of these bones of the skull, except for the TMJ, are held together by sutures. And you could always make up the name of a suture, right, just by putting an O between the two bones, the names of the two bones that they articulate with. Okay, on this picture, you don't see it very well, but here is an arch that's formed with a process coming off the maxilla and a process that's coming off the temporal bone. Okay, so in lab you got to make sure that you see this is an arch, there's a big space underneath it, and it's named after the zygomatic bone. So this is the zygomatic arch. And the way that processes are named on skull bones is not by the name of the bone that they exist on, but the name of the bone that they articulate with. So here is a process. It exists on the temporal bone, but we don't call that the temporal process. We name it after the bone that it articulates with, which is the zygomatic bone. So this is the zygomatic process of the temporal bone. Okay? Let's go, and until you see that, it's really confusing, but once you see it, it'll be really easy to remember. So here's another process right here. And it's on the zygomatic bone. So would we call that the zygomatic process? And that would be incorrect. What bone does it articulate with? It articulates with the temporal bone, so this is really the temporal process of the zygomatic bone. So that's how we would name that. And you're going to see that theme carried out for other kinds of features on bones, like depressions, like notches and things like that. They're not named after the bone that they are actually on, but named after the bone that is articulating with them. So here's another process on the zygomatic bone. And what bone does it articulate with? The frontal bone. So this is the frontal process of the zygomatic bone, right? So you don't have to memorize everything. Just learning nomenclature and how you name things is very important. And then here's another process over here. It articulates with what? The maxilla. So this would be the maxillary process of the zygomatic bone. Okay, so raise your hand if you want me to go over another description of this. It's awkward for me to teach you how to see it. But once you see it, it's really easy. Okay? Okay, and I guess what makes it complicated is that some editions of the textbook actually mislabel these processes. So even people that publish these textbooks have problems with that nomenclature. But it's really easy once you see it. All right, so here we have an orbit. And the orbit, is, as you can see, is made up of a number of bones, like the frontal bone and the zygomatic, right, and the maxillary bone. So here is the margin of an orbit, just the edge of the orbit. And then there's some smooth plates within the frontal bone and the zygomatic bone. So we call that an orbital plate. So here would be the orbital plate of the frontal bone. This right in here is the orbital plate of the maxilla. And then we have the orbital plate of the, here's the orbital plate of the maxilla. Here's the orbital plate of the zygomatic bone. All right, some other important processes. Mastoid process right here, big, massive process. So would you think a very small, dainty muscle attaches to that one, or a big, strong one, as opposed to the styloid process right here? Big, massive, strong muscle attaches to the mastoid process because it's what? It's big and massive, and muscles in the neck attach there to stabilize your neck region. Okay, smaller muscles attach to the styloid process on the temporal bone. We also see some foramina, like the mental foramen, on the external surface of the mandible. We also have a mandibular foramen, which we can't see right here because it's on the internal surface of the mandibular ramus, which we'll see in just a second. Okay, we have also a foramen here and a foramen up over here. Usually this would be the infraorbital foramen. This would be the supraorbital foramen because the socket right here is called an orbit. Okay, so this is a pretty important exam figure to know. And so let's look maybe at a little bit different view of this skull right here. Ah, that's a nice view, nice picture. All right, so but a posterior view now, we can see the sagittal suture, we can see the lambdoid suture, and every once in a while we find these variable bones within a suture of the skull. For instance, if a suture is forming just like this one on the right side of the skull, but all of a sudden then maybe, right, it separates from the occipital bone to put a little suture right here, you end up with something called a wormian bone. Because what does a suture look like? It just worms around on the surface of your skull, so sometimes we call those wormian bones or sutural bones. Right? Highly variable, you might have none, you might have two or three, all depending. All right, so here we have a process, but they're long and narrow. Since they're long and narrow, we call them lines. So since they're a process, guess what the function of this superior nuchal line is? Muscle attachment. That's right. So there are muscles in the back of your neck that attach right here, again, that help stabilize the neck, that attach to these lines, like the superior nuchal line, inferior nuchal line. This is not an exam figure, but you might have to know some of these things if they're in your lab list, right? All right, so here you have a nice frontal view of the skull. Now we can see the supraorbital foramen, infraorbital foramen, that's easy to see, right, and the orbit. In the pre-lecture reading assignment, you do have to know what bones make up an orbit, which bones actually come together to form the nasal cavity as well, right, so make sure you know that for the test. But what do we see? Sometimes this supraorbital foramen right here is very close to the orbital margin, the superior orbital margin right here, and it's just a notch. It's not a true foramen. It just forms a little indentation instead. Okay, now the reason why I like this view quite a bit is because now we can look into the orbit and I see the sphenoid bone over here, and I see the sphenoid bone over here, and how many sphenoid bones are there in the skull? That's a trick question, because it looks like it's bilateral. Looks like you have two, but you only have one. So this sphenoid bone is continuous. It goes all the way across the skull from right to left, and it helps make up the posterior part of the orbit right here. And we see some holes through it. We see the optic canal right here, but we also see some elongated foramina, and those we don't call foramina. We call them fissures, right, from the previous slide that I showed you. So here's the superior orbital fissure and inferior orbital fissure. But the optic nerve actually goes through the optic canal right here and right here. What else do we see? Well, we see the nasal bones, and we also see a separation of the nasal cavity. And we call that a septum. The septum is made of two bones. The superior bone right here is the ethmoid bone, and that's got to be my favorite bone of the cranium. Okay, and the inferior part of the nasal septum is the vomer right here. They come together. Right, so the vomer articulates with the maxilla. It's kind of like a knife blade. But we also see some other bones inside the nasal cavity, some shelves right here and right here. And the shelves are covered with a mucous membrane. It humidifies the air if it's really dry so your lungs don't desiccate. It warms the air up if the air is cold. If it's below your body temperature, it can also cool the air down if it's above your body temperature so that you can maintain homeostasis of your body temperature. Whoa, what does that mean, maintaining homeostasis of your body temperature? What can you tell me about your body temperature? Yeah, it's pretty much set, right? It shouldn't go too high or too low. If it does, we call that a disease state. Right, and if you're in a disease state, then you've lost homeostasis. So homeostasis is just maintaining physiologic parameters inside your body that keeps you in a healthy state. Your body temperature can go up a little bit, and as soon as it does, what happens? You start to sweat, which does what? Brings your body temperature down. And if your body temperature gets too cold, what do? You start to shiver, which brings your body temperature back up, right? So homeostasis doesn't mean that all these parameters are exactly constant. It only varies just in a little bit, but within a range so that you don't die with, say, for instance, hyperthermia or hypothermia. So these things help maintain your body temperature. These are called nasal conchae, and there's three on each side, so they're located bilaterally right here. Here's the inferior nasal conchae, and the middle nasal conchae, and the superior, we can't see with this diagram, and that's mostly because it's really, really small. It's part of the ethmoid bone. So the inferior and middle nasal conchae are separate bones. No. The middle nasal conchae is actually part of the ethmoid bone as well. The only one that's a bone all by itself is this inferior nasal conchae. Okay, and usually when we look at somebody right in the face, we can't see those things because this most anterior part of the nose is covered with what? A lot of cartilage. So we can't really look inside anybody's nasal cavity. All right. Okay. Yes.
That's a vomer.
Here's vomer right here.
Is it an independent bone or is it attached to the
maxilla? Oh, it's attached to the maxilla. Yeah, so here's the vomer, that inferior part of the nasal septum, vomer.
There's a suture between the vomer and the...
Oh, there certainly is. And so here is, right, the nasal septum. These are what we call perpendicular plates. Here's a perpendicular plate of the ethmoid bone. And another reason why you have nasal conchae and a septum right here is because of the way fluids behave when they move, okay? If a fluid can move in a very parallel, very what we call laminar flow, okay, then air can move very fast, without a lot of resistance. If there's turbulence in airflow or turbulence in any kind of motion of material, it becomes very resistive and it's hard to breathe. So all of these structures inside the nasal cavity maintain the air in what we call a laminar flow, so you can move a lot of air in and out of your body and it stays really nice and ordered. But if it starts to turn around and form vortexes, then it becomes very difficult to breathe. Okay, let's think of driving down the freeway. If everybody were just to stay in one lane, without changing lanes, you could go real fast. But as soon as everybody starts changing lanes, what do you got to do? You got to slow down because you got to look right and left, make sure you don't crash into somebody. So that's sort of a loose analogy right there. Okay, so ordered airflow is very easy to breathe. If it's turbulent, it's hard to inhale and exhale. So that's pretty much all the bones. Well, except for this lacrimal bone right here. That's a very tiny bone. I'll try to show you some other pictures. All right, so all these features, I think you pretty much have to know for the practicum. Like there is a little bump right here on the frontal bone. That's called the glabella. Deep to the and that bump is right there because deep to the glabella, there is a big cavity that we call the sinus. You feel that glabella right there? Okay, and that's what we call a paranasal sinus. You have four paranasal sinuses. There's one in the frontal bone. So we call that the frontal paranasal sinus, and it's a little, it extends both left and right within the frontal bone. There is a paranasal sinus in the maxilla, actually a very large one in the maxilla, both the right and left. So that's what we would call the maxillary paranasal sinuses. Also in the sphenoid, way back over here, the most posterior nasal sinus is in the sphenoid bone, in the body of the sphenoid. We'll look at that in just a second. So that would be the sphenoid paranasal sinus. And there are a lot of smaller ones in the ethmoid bone, and those are what we call the ethmoid paranasal sinuses. And you have a couple representations of where you find these things. All right, so this inferior view I don't spend a lot of time on, because the foramina, at least in lab, you should know from a superior aspect of the cranium looking down into the cranial vault, not the underside. And if you want to translate it to the underside, just put a little probe through a foramen and you can see where it comes out from the underside. But if you really understand from inside the cranial vault, you have a pretty good picture of what the inferior side of the skull looks like. Okay, so this bone you got to know. Temporal bone. Easy to tell because here is the external acoustic meatus, right? And that really is right there attached to your ear. That's how sound enters the temporal bone. So that you can hear, I'm going to show you a special part of the temporal bone on the other side. Here we got that nice mastoid process, spinous process. Here's another process. Why on earth do we call that the zygomatic process? Because it's articulating with the zygomatic bone, right? So it makes perfect sense. And then here's the flat region of the temporal bone. So that pretty much says it all. Here is the temporal bone right here. This is a view that you should be very familiar with because it shows you all of the cranial foramina, and that's a lab quiz, right? You actually have to draw this out. So let's talk about the temporal bone right here. So here's the internal acoustic meatus. If we follow that right across, you would run into what? The external acoustic meatus, which would be right here. These meatuses aren't connected. There's no way to go from one to the other because there are important apparatuses inside the temporal bone. This is actually a big, thick part of the temporal bone. Right, it kind of moves way up into the brain. This is what we call the petrous region of the temporal bone. Petrous region between the internal and external acoustic meati right here. So there are important organs for hearing and equilibrium and balance. All right, so here now we can see the extent of the sphenoid bone moving all the way from the right to the left part of the cranium. It has a number of foramina like the optic canal for the optic nerve. Right, then foramen ovale, rotundum, spinosum, and then part of the lacerum right here are important foramina. But there's also a depression right on the superior surface of the body of the sphenoid. So here's the body of the sphenoid. It's the most probably massive part of the sphenoid. Inside the body is the sphenoid paranasal sinus. But right on the top is a depression. And what's the function of a depression? It's for holding something, right? And it's actually named a fossa. But it's so special because of the organ it's holding, we give it a special name. We call it the cella turcica. And that just means Turkish saddle, because it kind of reminds somebody, must have been an equestrian, and it looks like a saddle that somebody would use to ride a horse with. And this is important because it holds the pituitary gland. Another name for the pituitary gland is hypophysis. And when we get to brain, you'll have to know that. It's not so important right now. So that's why this is called sometimes the hypophyseal fossa, but you should probably know it as the sella turcica. That's for holding the pituitary gland. All right, so what are all these foramina? Ah, here, let's talk about this one. Articulating with the sphenoid and the frontal bone right here is the ethmoid bone. And if you think now going down into the nasal cavity, what does the ethmoid bone, what does it make in the nasal cavity? The ethmoid bone, it makes the perpendicular plate, helps make the septum. The superior part is the nasal septum. It also has some nasal conchae on it. So the ethmoid bone is important because it allows you to breathe easy, right? It also air conditions the air, humidifies it. Ethmoid bone also has a paranasal sinus in there. So it fights infection. It keeps you healthy, right? This part of the ethmoid bone right here, which are horizontal plates, we call these the cribriform plates. And it has numerous holes in it that we call olfactory foramina. Foramina is plural. And the sense of olfaction is smell. And that's the most anterior sense organ that you have on your face, right? So these are the most anterior cranial fossa. So nerves for smell move through the cribriform plate into your nasal cavity. And so hence these are called the olfactory foramina within the cribriform plate. There's also a structure right here that you can't see very well from this aspect, but it kind of looks like a shark's fin sticking up between the frontal lobes. We call that the crista galli, and the membranes that surround the brain attach to the crista galli. So the ethmoid bone also is important because it helps hold your brain in place because it's holding that membrane, so when you turn your head, your brain doesn't slosh around inside your cranium. So I really like that ethmoid bone. It allows you to breathe, right? It keeps you healthy, keeps your brain nice and stable, allows you to smell, a whole number of functions, important functions, even though it's kind of a small bone. Okay, so that's pretty good from this view right here. So in lab, you should also look at these disarticulated bones. This is a pretty easy bone. I tell you what, maybe I should look at this list over here. We're doing pretty good. Yeah, we're doing pretty good. Okay, so here is a sphenoid bone. And here is the sphenoid bone within the cranium. So take it out, and it kind of looks like a bat or a bird or maybe a butterfly. So it has some wings. Here's a greater wing. Here's a lesser wing. This depression is the sella turcica. Here's the body of the sphenoid, and deep within the body of the sphenoid is a paranasal sinus. Right, you can see these on the mannequins that we have in the room in lab. All right, so those are some important landmarks on a sphenoid bone. A couple others. So here is the body. Deep, don't forget, deep to the body is the paranasal sinus. Sphenoid bone also helps make the superior orbital fissure, right? And the optic canal would be about in this region right here. But we also see on the inferior side of the sphenoid bone some bony plates that stick down. These are processes, all right? What would you guess the function of these processes are? Muscle attachment. And they are called the pterygoid. The P is silent, just like in pneumonia, right? So these are the pterygoid processes. And it's so important to really know your bones really well because you learn a lot of other kinds of anatomy at the exact same time. So guess what the name of the muscles are that attach to the pterygoid processes? The pterygoid muscles, right? And these are important muscles for mastication that eventually we'll get to. All right, so don't forget the shape of this sphenoid bone right here. So this is a pretty good view of the skull. It's probably not an exam figure, but it's illustrative because we can see the frontal paranasal sinus. We can see the sphenoid paranasal sinuses right here in the body of the sphenoid, right? Because we're right smack on midline. Okay. All right. So the other reason why I like this slide is now we can see the interior surface, the internal surface of the mandible, and there is that mandibular foramen right there. What's the function of this foramen? It's a passageway. It's a passageway for blood vessels as well as nerves, okay, which innervate the jaw, which then also innervate these teeth over here, right? So I don't know if any of you might be going into dental hygiene or dentistry. You're probably really interested with knowing these landmarks around here because you'll anesthetize that nerve so that you can actually work on these teeth, remove them or drill out a cavity or whatever. Okay, so don't forget about that mandibular foramen right there. All right, so we got frontal, parietal, occipital. Here's that temporal bone. Here's that internal acoustic meatus. This part of the temporal bone is really big and thick. And what do we call this region once again? It starts with a P. It's the petrous region. Petrous region of the temporal bone. Then here's the squamous region. Okay. All right, so here is that ethmoid bone. And here's the perpendicular plate that makes the superior part of the nasal cavity. Here's the crista galli that's sticking up into the brain, right, that holds your brain in place. One of the things that holds your brain in place. And then the lower part of the nasal septum is the vomer right here. So here's the vomer. It's only right on midline. Okay. Now, here's your oral cavity. The superior part of the oral cavity does have some bones. And anteriorly is the maxilla. And so this part we would just call the horizontal plate of the maxilla. Right? And so it helps make up part of the hard palate. So this roof of the mouth sometimes is called the palate. The hard palate has two bones in it. The soft palate just has soft tissue and muscle right here. So here is the maxilla. Posterior to the maxilla is the palatine bone. So here is palatine. And what is this thing between the palatine and the maxilla? That's a suture. Yeah, that's just a suture. Okay, here is the incisive foramen in the palatine bone because these teeth in the front right here are incisors, right? And then we have some canines, and then we have some molars, just for fun to talk about that. All right, now don't forget, we don't see it, but the ethmoid bone, just like the frontal bone and sphenoid bone, has what? Has a sinus. It has many little paranasal sinuses in it as well, which we can't see if we're just right on midline. They're going to be lateral on one side or the other. Okay, now in lab, maybe you've seen this palatine bone, all right, but it looks like an L. A palatine bone is an L, and my thumbs represent the horizontal plates of the palatine bone that make the hard palate. But these vertical plates of the palatine bone help make your nasal cavity. All right, so they're like a little L-shaped bone. It's kind of hard to see, but I'm going to show you palatine bone pretty soon. Okay, here's a nice zoomed-in region of an ethmoid bone. So here's that perpendicular plate that makes the nasal septum. Here are some nasal conchae that we talked about. Here's the middle nasal conchae. And I'm not sure I can even point out the superior nasal conchae. Don't forget the inferior one is a standalone bone all by itself. But we can look into the ethmoid bone, and what do we see right here? These are the ethmoid paranasal sinuses, right here. So here we have the cribriform plate. Anybody remember what goes through the cribriform plate? What goes through the cribriform plate? Where's that at? It is, right here. Here's the cribriform plate, a different view of it. So you see all the olfactory foramina going through the cribriform plate. Okay. We're right here. Okay, so that's a nice ethmoid bone because if you turn it on edge, it forms the letter E, right? Where this is the middle part of the E, this is the backbone of the E, here's the bottom part and the top part. And then here would be the crista galli that's poking up into the cranium. Mandible, you got to know some things about, like the body, mental foramen, mandibular foramen, the coronoid process for muscle attachment, and the mandibular condyle for forming articulation. Right, with the mandibular fossa to form the TMJ. And then what is this perpendicular part of the mandible called? That's the ramus, right? So any kind of perpendicular part of a bone is called the ramus. All right, so that's easy. This is easy to recognize too. Here's a maxilla, right? So here is the zygomatic process because what bone does it articulate with? The zygomatic bone. Here's the frontal process because it articulates with the frontal bone. All right, and we have a nice orbital plate or orbital surface. Here is the lower margin, inferior margin of the maxilla. It has a bunch of holes in it that we call alveoli. They're sockets to accept the root of a tooth. All right, so you can think of a tooth as being a plug that fits into the alveolar socket. So an alveolus is just like a little pocket of something. So the edge around an alveolus is the alveolar margin, and right on the alveolar margin, sometimes there's a little bony protuberance right here, and we would call that an alveolar process. All right, now, you could consider teeth bones, and of course the maxilla is a bone. So what do we call connective tissue, like dense regular connective tissue, which is a bone-to-bone connection? Bone-to-bone connection. A bone-to-muscle connection is a tendon, but what's a bone-to-bone connection? That's a ligament. So there are ligaments that hold your teeth into the alveoli, and those are just called periodontal ligaments. I don't know if that's certainly not on your list for lab. All right, so here is a process where you don't have a muscle attached to it, but you have a ligament attached to it, right? So processes could have either muscles or ligaments attached to it, just depending. So here is an exception to the rule that a process always has muscle attachment to it. All right, so here is just a little bit different view of just of the sinuses, nice sphenoid sinus, all right, frontal sinuses. Maybe I get a little peek of an ethmoid sinus right over here, but now I can see the vomer with respect to the ethmoid bone. And there's that nice incisive foramen. But here now we can see the palatine bone. All right, so here's the horizontal plate. Here's the perpendicular plate. So if you're like looking at my hand right now, where my thumb is the horizontal plate, my index finger is the vertical plate. But if you're going to look inside the nasal cavity, what would you do with those bones? Turn them like that. Okay, and so you can see that it makes the wall of the nasal cavity and also part of the hard palate as well. Okay, so sometimes this horizontal plate on the maxillary bone, we call it a process. What bone does it articulate with? It articulates with the palatine bone, so sometimes people might call that the palatine process of the maxilla. All right, so don't be confused if you hear that. And since this right here, the horizontal plate of the palatine bone, articulates with the maxilla, guess what some people call that? The maxillary process of the palatine bone. So you shouldn't be confused if you understand that nomenclature. All right, so that's pretty much good for most of the bones of the skull. All right, so here you can see the paranasal sinus again. Look at this big maxillary paranasal sinus, right, frontal, ethmoid, and then the sphenoid paranasal sinuses. But there are some other minor bones. There is the hyoid bone, which I don't think I have a picture of. I don't think I have a picture of a hyoid bone, but it's going to be inside the mandible. Oh, you do have one in there someplace. Oh, we're getting to it. Can I see it? Here. Hyoid bone. Okay, so here's a hyoid bone. And you can't really feel that one because there's so many muscles surrounding it. And if you press hard enough to actually feel it, you might actually break it, so I wouldn't even try because it's a pretty dinky bone. So you see a bunch of processes on it. You don't have to know anything about the hyoid bone other than it is there. It does not articulate with any other bone. It's just it's floating, right? And it has a number of muscles that are important for articulation and breathing and swallowing. So if you're going into speech pathology, you're interested in this bone and all the muscles that are associated with it because it's important for articulation. Okay, other bones that are in the skull. Typically, we don't talk about them right now, but they are located within the petrous region of the temporal bone. All right, so here we see nice occipital with foramen magnum. Right, the internal acoustic meatus is going to be about in this region. External is going to be over here. So this region is the petrous region. Maybe now with this photograph, you can see it's a little bit more massive part of the temporal bone. Right, there are bones within the temporal bone that we call auditory ossicles. And there are three on each side. And I could tell you I have all three between my fingers right here. And you could not disagree with me. Why is that? Because they are really small bones, right? So you couldn't see them if I had them there or not. Okay, so those are auditory ossicles. When we get to hearing, they're important for hearing. That's when we'll discuss them, but they're inside the skull, right? And auditory means associated with the sense of hearing. And ossicles, anytime you hear that term, osteo, you should think of bone. So an ossicle is just a bony structure, right? And it's used for hearing. Okay, so those are inside the skull. All right, so that takes us to vertebral column. And is vertebral column part of the axial skeleton? Absolutely, right? So don't forget, you got a number of different divisions of the vertebral column. You got cervical, thoracic, lumbar, sacral, and coccygeal. And you got to know how many vertebrae are in each division, but that's really not such a big deal because you can use your little quasi-mnemonic to help remember that. Like you have breakfast at 7 for cervical, lunch at noon for thoracic, and dinner at 5 for lumbar. All right, so what makes a thoracic vertebrae a thoracic vertebrae? It has to have something attached to it. A rib, right. So how many pairs of ribs do you have? You have 12, because most people have, 12 thoracic vertebrae, they have 12 ribs. Not everybody, but I would guess probably everybody in here. But if somebody had maybe 11, that wouldn't surprise me too much. It's a little bit of a variable region. Not as highly variable, for instance, as the coccygeal region right here. We'll probably find people with 3, might find some people with 5 coccygeal vertebrae all fused together to form that one tailbone or coccyx right here. Right, the sacrum is pretty much the same way. There are 5 vertebrae that fuse together to form the sacrum. All right, all of the other vertebrae, at least in young individuals that are healthy, these are all articulating via an intervertebral disc, but some of these joints ossify as we get older, and of course then we lose mobility when that happens. Only 2 of these vertebrae have names. Most of them have numbers named after what they're in terms of from superior to inferior in the division that they're located in. So since there are 12 thoracic vertebrae, here would be thoracic number 1, and way down over here would be thoracic number 12, but we would just abbreviate that by saying, here's T1, here's T2, and that stands for thoracic, so you should know what division that's in. The same thing for cervical. Number 1 is the most superior, number 7 is the most inferior. That number 7 kind of sticks out in the back right here. If you feel the back of your neck, it kind of protrudes out. We call that the cervical prominens. You should see that on the skeleton we have in lab. Okay. And the other thing that maybe from lab you can remember is that every cervical vertebrae has a special little hole in the transverse process that we call a transverse foramen that allows a blood vessel to go through these vertebrae directly up to the brain to feed blood to the brain. And C1 and C2 have special names. C1 is holding up your cranium, so we call that the atlas. And since C2 has a little special feature, it has the body of C1 attached to its body. It forms a little axis so that rotation can take place between C1 and C2. Therefore, we call C2 the axis. So you can rotate your head between C1 and C2. But you can't rotate between the occipital bone and C1. That's going to break C1. Right, so that motion is not allowed. But you can flex and extend, and that's what we call a yes motion. The no motion is between C1 and C2. Right, that's just a little review from lab. All right, if we look at the spine right here, we notice that it deviates to the right a little bit, okay, because guess what's in the thoracic cavity that's mostly on the left? Your heart. All right, so it forms a little indentation of the spinal cord. That's normal. But you see some more major curvatures, right, if you look at a lateral view. So here is the cervical curvature, which protrudes the spine anteriorly. Here's a thoracic curvature, which protrudes the spine posteriorly. And then there's another curvature called the lumbar curvature, which protrudes the spine anteriorly. And then there's even a third one, the sacral curvature, which protrudes the spinal column posteriorly. So why do we have these curvatures right here? Let's start with this sacral curvature. Because in this region, think of this as like being a fossa. What's the function of a fossa? It holds something. So in this region right here, it's holding what? Pelvic organs. All right, that's an important thing. All right, and in the thoracic region, we see like another fossa formed by the thoracic curvature right here. So what's being held in this region right here? Heart and lungs, right? Now, why do we have these more anterior curvatures here and here? That's just to distribute weight, all right? So if all of the weight was distributed posteriorly on your body, and you just kind of relax, what would happen to you? You'd fall over backwards, right? So the cervical curvature and lumbar curvature are just ways to redistribute weight so that you have it more on the center line in a coronal plane of your body. So these posterior curvatures are there for holding organs that are big, take up a lot of space. These anterior curvatures are just there to distribute weight so that you have an easier time with your posture. Okay. Oh, we also have, well, let me go to a vertebrae. You had to draw this vertebrae. So you're really familiar with a typical vertebrae with the body, right, and the pedicle, lamina, the vertebral arch. All right, and we see just one foramen right here, which is the vertebral foramen. You should know what goes through there. That is the spinal cord, right? Sometimes we might find the transverse foramina if it's a cervical vertebrae that we see right here for the vertebral arteries that go up to the brain. So make sure they're there. Now this vertebrae, I could ask you, which one is this? It has a funny shape. You know it's cervical, but it is also C1 or atlas because it's missing the body right here. All right, so here's the anterior, here's posterior part. Remember the vertebral bodies are what? Anterior on a vertebrae. The spinous process is posterior. The C1 basically doesn't have much of a spinous process, so we just call that the posterior tubercle. That's probably not on your lab list. But here's where the vertebral body would be. Where did it end up? It's missing. It didn't disappear completely. It has been attached to C2. So here is C2. Here's the body of C1. We call it the dens or odontoid process that forms a little axle or a point of rotation so that C1 can actually rotate on top of C2 on these articulating surfaces so that you can laterally rotate your head. Now, you don't see any transverse foramina in this picture. Why is that? It's a cervical vertebrae. Would you expect to see transverse foramina in this vertebrae? Absolutely, you should. It's just it's a lousy picture. It's underneath this condylar surface, right? It's right in here and right in there. So that's always a dead giveaway if something is a cervical vertebrae. All right, so here you can see that nice transverse ligament that stabilizes C1 and C2 around the dens, right, which stabilizes the neck. And then here is C7 or the vertebral prominence. One other hole besides transverse foramina and vertebral foramina that you should be aware of, and that is, put all of the vertebral foramina together. What do you get? And you look down that tunnel. What's another name for a tunnel in anatomy? A canal, right? A canal. So all the vertebral foramina line up to form the vertebral canal, but there is still another foramen in the vertebral column that you have to be aware of. And let's look, oh, sorry about this. I think I have, let me look here. I didn't mean to. Okay, let's look at this lateral view of the spinal cord right here. In order to see this foramen, you actually have to put a couple vertebrae together. All right, so here is the intervertebral foramen. When you put a couple vertebrae together, it forms a hole. And that allows spinal nerves to leave the spinal cord to innervate the peripheral parts of your body. So that's got to be there. Okay. Now, if we look at these vertebrae right here and right here. Oh, let me see if I can slide this over. Like that. Maybe zoom it in a little bit. Okay, I'm going to ask you a question. I see like a little dimple right here that's really smooth. And I see a little dimple right here on the transverse process. That's really smooth. Does anybody know, remember from lab what those things are called? Those are facets. So here is, and a facet is for articulation. That's a little bit of a hint. So here's a facet, a transverse facet. Here is a demifacet. It's just half of a facet because here is half of another facet right here. This forms one facet. So here's a superior demifacet. Here's the inferior demifacet. So what kinds of vertebrae are these right here? Thoracic. Some people saw that right away. How did you know that was thoracic? How did you know this is a thoracic vertebrae? Because the spinous process is long and narrow and inferiorly angled. That's not bad. Okay, not a bad idea. But here's a better idea. What bones articulate with thoracic vertebrae? Besides other thoracic vertebrae? Ribs. All right, so these demifacets right here articulate with the head of a rib, And this transverse facet right here articulates with the tubercle of a rib, right? And what division of the vertebral column articulate with ribs? Is it cervical or thoracic or lumbar? It's only thoracic, right? So since we see articulation for ribs, then these have to be thoracic vertebrae, right? So you see that by these demifacets, and demi just means half of a facet. Okay. You probably should be aware of not only the normal curvatures, but some abnormal curvatures of the spinal cord. Okay? So an exaggerated thoracic curvature, we call that kyphosis, when you have even a bigger hump on your thoracic region, more than your cervical prominence, right? And you could have a lordosis if that's an exaggeration of the lumbar curvature, but you can also have a lateral curvature, extenuated lateral curvature, we call that scoliosis. And that can be bad for the following reason. Okay, let me zoom back out right here. All right, I don't have a picture, I don't think, in the book, but a lateral curvature, right, is going to cause a deviation of the spinal cord. Instead of being straight up and straight down, a lateral curvature, and then these vertebral bodies right here will not articulate properly. They should be, I'll use my two hands to describe this, okay? So the vertebral body should be flat on top of each other, just like that. But if there's lateral curvature, guess what happens to that articulating surface? It starts to bend like that, and then it pinches. And when it pinches like that, it pinches off the intervertebral foramen. And what is going through that intervertebral foramen? There are nerves going through there. And so now you've stopped nerve conduction through that foramen, and that produces pain, that produces loss of motion, loss of control in that particular body region, or inappropriate sensation, right? If these things start to bend laterally, it pinches off that intervertebral foramen. So scoliosis can be a very important problem for some people. Okay. Okay, let's go to rib cage. Well, we talked about this. So how many pairs of ribs do you have?
12.
Only 12, right? Same number as thoracic vertebrae. And the superior seven are what we call true ribs because they articulate with the sternum directly via some costal cartilage. And then the inferior five are what we call false ribs because they either don't articulate with the sternum at all, like ribs number 11 and 12, there's no cartilage at all, but 8 through 10, all right, do have costal cartilage, but they articulate with the costal cartilage of the rib above them. So these are what we call false ribs. So false ribs include these right here as well as the floating ribs as well. Okay, you should know some parts of a rib, I suppose. Let's see, where's a rib? I see one rib. I guess this is our picture of a rib right here. Okay, one end of the rib, we call that the head because it's big and thick. It articulates with what? The demifacets of a thoracic vertebrae. A tubercle of a rib right here articulates with transverse process or the transverse facet. Right here, and then we have the angle and shaft of a rib right here, and then on the inside we have a costal groove. A costal groove is really a fossa, but it's elongated. So what's the function of this costal groove right here? What's the function of a fossa? It holds something, right? So there are blood vessels and nerves that course around to your anterior muscles through this costal groove. So these ribs protect those blood vessels and nerves that move anteriorly. Okay, so that's a nice rib to look at. Sternum. Oh, there's a few other things I want to talk about. That intervertebral disc. Look in lab. We have some models of normal intervertebral discs and abnormal ones. And I don't have any pictures of an intervertebral disc. Did I see that here? No, gee whiz, I thought I saw it someplace. Okay, well, here's an intervertebral disc. It's got two parts. The outer part is what we call the annulus fibrosus. It's a ring of very strong fibrocartilage. Right, so it's tough. The inner part has more of a gel-like material in it. It's called the nucleus propulsus. So when these vertebral bodies start to pinch, maybe inappropriate rotation or lateral bending of the spinal cord, it can compress the intervertebral disc, and it might start to bulge out into the spinal cord, or it can bulge out into this intervertebral foramen right here. Right, and then it's going to cause nerve damage when that happens. Right, so when the nucleus, or when the annulus fibrosus is damaged, the nucleus propulsus can actually leak out of the intervertebral disc to cause neurological problems. Okay, that's that. What else? In the neonate brain, let's talk about that. The sutures are not formed, like what we see right here. So here's a neonate. And that's important for a parturition because the cranium has to squish around and bend to get out the birth canal. And even there are major parts between brains that are still fibrous membranes. And here we call those fontanelles. So here's anterior fontanelle, posterior fontanelle that are right on midline. And then laterally we have the sphenoidal fontanelle and mastoidal fontanelle. So you have to know these four fontanelles for lab. And they're important for, number one, parturition, but they're also important because the brain is going to grow and expand rapidly, and if the cranium was ossified, it wouldn't allow for expansion of the brain during development. So that's another important reason for these fontanelles. And, of course, you should also be aware, how long do they exist in somebody? Up to 2 years, right? So, obviously, a neonate brain is in danger from puncture wounds, but not just puncture wounds, but any kind of vibration or twisting of the skull can also damage the brain as well. So not just puncture wounds. So let's see. What else is there for axioskeleton? Well, the sternum. We could go over the sternum really fast. Where's that at? That's sometimes we call that the breastbone. And here's the sternum. Sometimes there's a foramen in the sternum right here. That's not such a big deal. If you have one, a brother, sister, or cousin, whatever, that's just an anatomic variation. But here's the body of the sternum. Inferior to that is the xiphoid process, which is cartilage in this illustration, but that ossifies. I'm sure it's bone in all of us right now. And here's the manubrium, the top part of the sternum. And so there are sutures between all these different parts of the sternum. Right, so sometimes we would call this the manubrial sternal joint, right? And this would be the xiphoid sternal joint right here, because that's a xiphoid process. That forms the manubrial sternal joint, forms a little angle that you can palpate, right? That forms the sternal angle. You have some depressions in the sternum, like the jugular notch right here, clavicular notches bilaterally, because there's a bone that articulates right at this location right here. Those of you that I've only had one lab so far to look at appendicular skeleton, but anybody know the name of the bone that articulates with the manubrium right here? It is the clavicle, right? And so that would be the manubrioclavicular joint right there. And this is the only joint that is holding your arm to your axial skeleton. Your arm is attached by a lot of muscles to your axial skeleton, but this is the only joint. It's a really small joint. That's kind of amazing to think of that. All right, so that's pretty much it for axial skeleton. Unless I can remember something, I'll bring it up next time. So please sign the sign-in sheet. Oh, I didn't go over sternum. Sacrum. I didn't go over sacrum. Make sure you go over sacrum, or maybe I'll say a couple words about sacrum next time, which will be Monday. But Monday's a holiday, so don't come to school because you'll be very lonely. Is my light still green? Okay. Thank you.